bed. I couldn't go to bed. My head's too light to try to set it down. Sleep, sleep, I couldn't sleep tonight. Not for all the jewels in the crown. I could have danced all night. I could have danced all night. And still have begged for more. I could have spread my wings and done a thousand things I've never done before. I'll never know what made it so exciting. Why all at once my heart took flight. I only know when he began to dance with me. I could have done.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios, this week on Broadway for Sunday, June 18th, 2017. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Masterworks Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, Everything Sondheim, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Morning.
Good morning. So we've had a few days to let this sit into and sink in. What did we think about the Tony Awards? Peter, what was your overall take on the Tonys?
Are we talking about the show itself, or are we talking about the actual awards? That's
yes.
What it really comes down to, doesn't it?
Yes.
People have criticized the TV show itself for being very insular at the very beginning. There was Kevin Spacey with a cast on his arm, and there was Kevin Spacey with a cast on his leg, and there are two references to Michael Riedel. And while I understand, and the moment I saw the cast, in fact, I thought, whoa, wait a minute. Is America going to understand this? I would like to at least acknowledge the fact that there's a possibility that the people putting this together said, you know, let's face it, we're not going to get people who aren't interested in theater watching this, so why don't we center on people who are going to get these inside jokes? And because I've often said, if my favorite performers of all time, Stockard Channing, Donna Murphy, Bernadette Peters, were all giving out the Country Music Awards, I wouldn't go see – I wouldn't watch the show. I mean, I'm not interested in country music. So as a result, you can't get me to watch the Country Music Awards, and there are people you can't get to watch the Tony Awards. So maybe they were trying to do true theatergoers a favor because – yes, of course, the Radio City audience knows what's going on, but you heard that immediate laughter when they saw the cast. And so, really, I will defend them on that level for trying to appeal to the people who really care. That's one of the wonderful things about being in the audience at the Tonys, that you really, really are people who care so much about what happens. So maybe they're letting those people in the TV audience feeling that they were part of that audience too. So I am not as condemning as other people have been about the fact that, my God, all these inside jokes. Yeah, maybe that was the intention.
Michael, what did you think?
I can see both sides of the insular argument, and it certainly didn't bother me personally. But on the other hand, how does that fit in with Kevin Spacey doing a Johnny Carson impression?
Yeah.
That just seemed – I mean, and – don't get me wrong. I thought it was an excellent impression.
Astonishingly good. Yeah.
I think it was the best I've ever seen, but I just don't know what that has to do with theater or the Tonys. So I guess they were trying to play both ends against the middle, if that's the correct term. And sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. As far as the show itself overall, I thought it moved very well. And I thought a lot of the writing was very good. And I have no objection that I can think of to any of the choices. Some of them were surprises, and I'm always surprised when the best play or the best musical does not have the best director. You know, I always think that's odd, whether it's the Oscars or the Tonys or whatever. I think I mentioned that last week, and I can, there's all kinds of justifications for it, but I still think ultimately the director has ultimate responsibility for the total package. So I thought that was a little weird.
It has happened in recent times, Brian Brooks wrote me and said, noticed that it happened in 06 when Jersey Boys was the musical, Pajama Game, the revival, and Sweeney Todd got direction in the musical categories. And also in 02 when Millie was the musical, Into the Woods was the revival, and Urinetown was the direction. So it does seem to happen every now and then, though that's a while ago. He also pointed out that it happened in 02 for The Goat, winning play in Private Lives Revival, and Metamorphosis was the direction. So it's not unheard of, but yes, it is rare. It is rare.
Were there any, in the categories, any big upsets that you, or interesting choices maybe that you thought about?
Well, I did say last week that I wanted Rachel Chafkin to win for Natasha. That was the only one I wanted, and that's the one I certainly didn't get. And by the way, I think Christopher Ashley did a phenomenal job of Come From Away. I do. I have no issue with the fact that he was quite an achiever with that show, because you do have 11 people and they have to play both the Americans and the Canadians. And wow, you know, I mean, it really was stunning. In another year, I wouldn't have begrudged him the award at all. And again, I'm not going to kill myself over it, but still, that was the big surprise to me. And the group of people I was with, too, the roar in the room showed that I was not the only one surprised. So that was my big shock.
Okay. Michael, how about you? What did you think?
No major surprises. I was a little surprised that Gavin Creel won. And I think I said that, again, only because I don't think it's the type of role that generally wins awards. But certainly I'm very happy for him. I think he sings it better than anyone I've ever heard and acts it as well as it can be acted. So that was one of the few things that approached a surprise to me. But again, also the director not being the same as the musical.
Well, what's really interesting about the Dolly thing, Gavin Creel winning, is way back in 1964, Dolly won 10 awards, and it was nominated for 11. And the one it didn't win was this award, Best Featured Actor in a Musical, and it was the same part. Indeed, Cornelius, played by Charles Nelson Reilly at the time. The interesting fact about that, too, a second interesting fact, as I insist, is that the person who won that year was from another season, as we think of it, because the Tonys in those days used to use April 15th as a cutoff date.
Right.
So April 15th, 1963, was the cutoff date for the new season. And She Loves Me opened on April 23rd, 1963. So while most of us don't think of it as a member of the 1963-64 season because of the Tony cutoff being early, Jack Cassidy won in that category for She Loves Me, playing Kadai, the grand knowing you part. So I couldn't help noticing that was kind of fun that had happened. Another irony, which has to do with the Drama Desk Awards, Hal Prince came out to give the revival in a musical winner, and it turned out to be Hello, Dolly, which turns out to be interesting, too, from the vantage point that he was originally offered the chance by David Merrick to direct Hello, Dolly, and said, no, I don't think so. And by the way, you got to get rid of that Hello, Dolly number. It's so stupid. I mean, my God, they don't know who she is. What's this, coming back to the restaurant? That's ridiculous. Drop it. Well, they didn't. And I just wonder what was going through Hal Prince's head when he was asked to do that category, fully knowing, as all of us did, that Dolly was going to win, if he even gave a thought to it. I mean, it was just like, you know, I mean, Hal Prince doesn't have to worry about the things he turned down or the opportunities he missed. Even if he only did Phantom of the Opera, he'd be set for the rest of his life. So, but two ironies in the awards category this year do involve Hello, Dolly for that reason, for those reasons.
One final thing, just to clarify, as I said, I'm always surprised when the best play or best musical does not also get best director. And in this case, neither one did. So that's doubly surprising. But a lot of people have referred to this year's Tonys as very much spreading the wealth. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. So I'm not complaining. Don't get me wrong.
No, I like when the wealth is spread, and I do have a feeling that has to do with television, that they really want somebody to get everything. I truly believe that if the 1964 Tonys had been televised, that Barbara Streisand would have beaten Carol Channing in the Best Actress in a Musical race, because I think they would have wanted to give Funny Girl something. But yeah, they weren't famous then, the Tonys. I mean, even if you look at marquees from way back when, you will notice that musicals will often say, winner, New York Drama Critics Circle Award, winner, Tony Award. That comes second in so many of those old shows, because the Critics Circle Award was considered a more prestigious prize and a more famous prize even. So because that started before the Tonys did. So but TV has made the big difference, needless to say.
Yeah. Could you ever see a point where the Tonys get unseated as the big 800-pound gorilla in the room?
What I always think of is college basketball. At one time, the NIT was the big tournament, and the NCAA was not. And as time went on, the NIT certainly took a backseat to the NCAA. So I guess anything is possible. But as so many people have told me over the years, that word Tony Award really does mean something. It's a nice word. And back in the old days when Isabel Stevenson was running it, I've been told that she ruled with an iron hand, and she got what she wanted, because she said, excuse me, we own this name, and by all means, go and have whatever award show you want to have, but it ain't going to be called the Tonys unless it's being done my way. So that's changed over the years. But so it's going to be a long time if it ever happens. But because it happened in college basketball, I think there's always the possibility that it could happen in Broadway theater, too.
So my thought about this is that just like the NIT, the NCAA's unseated the NIT because of television. And the Tony Awards ratings were down 36% or so over last year. And again, brings up the question, how long is CBS going to continue to broadcast the Tony Awards? So
apparently,
we have this discussion all the time. And,
apparently, as long as Les Moonves is there, who really believes in them, and also the theory that because you are dealing with an educated, affluent audience that watches it, therefore the advertisers are interested because they can target into their audience. So who knows? A lot of us wouldn't mind terribly if it went to cable, if indeed the show would turn out to be something that would acknowledge the people who get virtually no time at all. A lot was said about James Earl Jones not getting enough time because there he was, lifetime achievement, and there he was, one of those in the pack of not being allowed to get up on stage, and we hear everything he said while so much time was given to something else. That's a good time to mention Johnny Carson is something we didn't need as much as seeing James Earl Jones. And so that's a big factor as well. We would... I loved when PBS did the first 10 awards. You know, I mean,
too.
I thought that was terrific because we did get to see everything there. So that was very sad, you know, that he was given the back seat. I also found it extraordinarily interesting that Best Score was actually fully on camera, while Best Book was abridged and done earlier. And now I knew this would happen years ago when Cyndi Lauper was eligible for Kinky Boots, because she's famous in the country. And again, they were hoping that the average person would tune in to see Cyndi Lauper accept her award. This year, it's of interest to me because, of course, Ben Pasek and Justin Paul are extraordinarily hot. They'd already won an Oscar. And I have a feeling, had they not won the Oscar, that award would have also been off camera as well. That they're become celebrities in their own world. And so why not acknowledge them? I think the Tonys didn't want to embarrass themselves by not giving Tony Awards to the people who had just won the Oscar. None of this is a criticism of whether or not they deserved it. Not at all. All I'm saying is that I truly believe that the Oscar had a lot to do with their getting their award on camera as opposed to being taped and shown later.
Also, just briefly, if I understand correctly, it wasn't so much that the ratings were down this year as that they were way up last year with Hamilton.
Hamilton, yeah.
And what does it – it's so interesting. I mean, we could get into an hour's discussion of this, which I promise we won't. But what does that tell us? It tells us that it's celebrities in themselves are not maybe the main factor.
I was stunned years ago when I when going to the Tony site shortly after the awards, and they had a little piece there saying, "Why do you watch the Tony Awards?" And I think it was something like 62% said to see the numbers, not to see the winners. I think the winners was like 18% or something. I cannot swear to these figures, but believe me, there was an enormous disparity between I just want to see the songs and I want to see who won. And that really surprised me.
All the more reason why there was such disappointment over no representation of Bette Midler as Dolly Levi.
Couldn't the compromise have been put on your Sunday clothes? I mean, according to my records, there are four lines that she has to sing in that song. And it would have given – first off, I think it's one of the great songs in Broadway history. One of the great production numbers as well. So it also would have shown off those wonderful costumes that would later win the Tony Awards. So, or before, depending on when they scheduled it. But wow, you know, really, couldn't they talk her into four lines? I hope somebody at least made the suggestion.
If indeed that was really the issue, vocal preservation.
Yeah. It makes no sense to me why that didn't happen. And by the way, I do believe that if they had done that, people would have appreciated also getting Penny in My Pocket if they wanted to do both of them. It's just that as the sole representation of the show, it certainly was, to use a line that David Hyde Pierce used in Curtains, lackluster.
So, Peter, as longtime listeners and longtime readers of your columns will know that you've been a champion for Benj Pasek and Justin Paul for many years before the hit Dear Evan Hansen. So what's it like for you? Do you get a little bit of pride there to see them up on stage, having seen them from their very beginnings?
Yeah, sure, because I did see their very first show called Edges, which I really thought was wonderful, and just a review, which they did when they were in Michigan. But, you know, I mean, you win some, you lose some. I have to admit that way back in the 60s, I went to see a comedian, a political comedian, David Fry, at a nightclub in Boston, and a whole bunch of us went, all my friends, I mean, about 10 of us, because we all loved the political humor that David Fry could do. And we hated the person who opened for him. We thought she was terrible, and that was Bette Midler. So, you know, you win some, you lose some. So one has to be humbled by the ones that one misses, as opposed to crowing about the ones that one gets.
And by the way, quickly, last year or so, we interviewed Gerard Lobo, who was doing an off Broadway production of Romeo and Juliet he and his Morgan DeTogne, who was his Juliet, and they did this really interesting Bollywood production of Romeo and Juliet, but it was very, very off Broadway, and we really just did it because of the concept and because I thought that these two actors were going places. And then Gerard did a couple of other off Broadway shows. And then he got hooked up with Aziz Ansari and wound up on TV in that. And now he has a big part in Orange is the New Black. So it can happen very quickly when it happens.
Mm. Oh, it sure can. It sure can. Certainly, we've seen it before and we'll see it again. And it's wonderful when it does happen. Of course, it's so sad to me how many people have said to me, okay, you've known Ben and Justin for a while. Do you think this is going to go to their heads? You think they're going to become terrible people? And it's how people always go to that immediately. That you know, we certainly have seen instances where power does corrupt. I will say that somebody I saw in Alabama in a play, and I named him the best actor of the year, and he knew about it. And much later, he was terrible to me when I needed an interview. Just terrible. Yes, that can happen. It really can. But I'm going to bet that Benj and Justin turn out to be and continue to be the nice guys they have been.
They talked about in the press room, they talked about others. They didn't talk about themselves. They talked about Stephen Schwartz, and they talked about Jeff Marks, and they talked about the Broadway community, and they didn't talk about themselves, which I think is they had just gotten the trophy and came into the press room, and they talked about how wonderful everybody else is and how the Broadway community embraced them, and that's the only reason why they were able to do it. They talked about they were going through some financial straits when they were trying to keep writing and shows and not turn to a different way to make money. And Jeff Marks wrote them a check and said, you can pay me back when your first show's on Broadway. And they told this story. I don't think that it's going to go to their heads. I hope it doesn't, but they seem like really great guys. I wanted to mention two other things that I thought were a little bit overlooked in the hubbub of the Tony Awards. Nigel Hook won for The Play That Goes Wrong and the Best Scenic Design of a Play, and we all joked about all the really wonderful things in The Play That Goes Wrong and how the set just implodes upon itself every night, 8 times a week.
Yes.
And I really love that happens. And Jane Greenwood mm-hmm. won for Best Costume Design of a Play for The Little Foxes. And has she been nominated 29 times? Is that what she had? Is that before? And this is her first win?
Certainly it's in the 20s. And I have to admit that I was rooting for Susan Hilferty, given that I knew her when I was a high school teacher. And did I ever mention this? Have I talked about this?
I don't think so.
Yeah, Susan Hilferty from Arlington, Massachusetts, was part of the drama club when I was teaching at Arlington High School in Arlington, Massachusetts, and in fact was a phenomenal Jean Brody and a phenomenal Sabina in Skin of Our Teeth there. I directed her in the third play of Plaza Suite, where the girl was locked in the bathroom and she was the mother who was going distraught. So while I begrudged Jane Greenwood nothing, and Sue has also won for Wicked and is certainly one of our most potent set designers. I'm sorry, costume designers, and doesn't need the award. Believe me, I was pulling for her for old time's sake.
And then as we transition out of this, I wanted to mention that Rebecca Taishman won for Best Direction of a Play for Indecent. And mm-hmm. And we
for all the good it did the show, yeah.
And we got the sad news that this wasn't able to pull Indecent out, and a number of shows announced closings this week. Indecent, Six Degrees. What was there was another one that was announced.
Sweat.
That's right. Sweat was
all
also
plays.
Announced.
All plays.
Yeah. During the Tony Awards, there was a. I'm going to say satire of product placement in the middle of the Tony Awards, where they had a little thing for Waitress with Sarah Bareilles came out, and they had a Charlie and the Chocolate Factory commercial right in the middle of the show, and then they had the cannolis from The Bronx Tale come out in the middle, and then Kevin Spacey talked about his two-night-only play that was this week. And Peter and Michael both got a chance to see that. So I don't even know the name of it. So Peter wanted to tell me what the name of it is and how was it?
Well, Clarence Darrow, it's a play that one person showed that Henry Fonda did back in the 70s. And in the 70s, he did it at the Helen Hayes Theater. Now, that's not the same Helen Hayes Theater we have now, I'll grant you. But it certainly was a house that wasn't nearly as big as Arthur Ashe Stadium, which is where he did it. This is a venue that has 23,771 seats, though they did block off the upper level quite a bit. So at the end of the show, he talked to the audience and said, people thought I was crazy to do this. I still think he was. Of course, he can do a good deal of business there. It's right near that wonderful Unisphere that's from the 64-65 World's Fair. If one were to go, I hope one allowed a great deal of time, because it was quite a walk from the subway to the to the actual stadium itself. So, but anyway, you know, this was a bizarre thing, and especially because we're talking about a play that is all words and no action. And unfortunately, you know, sports stadia, I mean, you get that echo whenever anything happens. So here we are in a play that depends on words more than anything else. And while there were times that certainly Clarence Darrow came across as warm and fuzzy, he was never as fuzzy as the sound was. So so that was a big problem. Also, you know, I mean, you have to understand that more than 90% of the time he wasn't facing you. And so that made it hard to hear, too. Now, there were jumbotrons, four of them, that showed us what was going on. But you know, a live theater thing, you want to see live theater. And I have to admit that my eyes were on himself much more than on the jumbotrons, because I'm used to watching people and not TV when I go to see a legitimate show. So many times he would get a laugh from a good deal of the house, but other people were busy saying to the person they came with, what did he say? So, and then the airplanes, okay, yeah. The ones coming or going from LaGuardia. I mean, you know, every now and then he would be very clever in the way he finessed it. He would act as if the pause he was giving was actually a pause in the play. But then there were times you could see he just felt the hell with it and he just plowed on. So so that was that. So I was reminded of the Max Bialystock line, you know, the theater in the square, nobody had a good seat. And that was also true of theater in the rectangle, because there he was on center court. So you know, I would like another chance with this play, which, by the way, I could easily get, because Henry Fonda's version of it is right there on YouTube, the entire thing. So it seems short to me, too. It seemed long to me in another place, in another way. But it did seem short to me. But I did check, and it's exactly the same length that it was when Fonda did it, which really did surprise me. He tried. He came into the audience a number of times. He even sat between two people who couldn't believe their good fortune to be this close to Kevin Spacey. But that was the real problem. I wish he would have done it in a conventional theater, because I think he was good. And I was interested in the play, too, hearing about these cases, some of which were famous. I expected more from the Scopes trial. I don't mean that as a criticism. I just thought that would be the main event. And it really wasn't. The Leopold and Loeb case, I think, was more of an event than the Scopes. I'm not 100% sure of that, but that would be my estimate on that. But just, you know that Cole Porter song, it's the wrong time in the wrong place. Well, you know, this was the wrong show in the wrong place. So,
all right, Michael, what did you think?
Well, first of all, I sat directly in front of Peter for this show.
That's right.
So we had almost exactly the same experience in that sense. I'm not sure, Peter, if that's true about the length, because actually they sent out a script to reviewers on the day of the performance that we attended, I think. And I noticed when I opened it up that the first thing it says at the top is edit 2. So I think, I mean, when you figured that out, were you really accounting for the late start and the huge intermission?
Well, the gentleman with whom you came told us it started at 8:19 and
right.
ended, It ended at 9:03, the first act. So that's about, 35 minutes? 40
yeah.
minutes?
Yeah.
But the and the second act was 9:28 to, I think, 10:03. But the thing is, at least what's on YouTube is 80 minutes as well. So so that may be abridged, you know. And
Maybe I'm thinking maybe I wasn't sure when I first heard this announced. I wasn't sure if it was the old play Clarence Darrow by David Rintles.
It is, yeah.
But it is, yeah. And I guess we can go to the drama bookshop and get the script and look at it. I did think it ended very abruptly. So that's one reason why I felt that it might have been edited. And also, some of the construction of it seemed very odd, and I thought that might have done with editing also. One interesting thing about it is that he mentions Leopold and Loeb at one point in passing. Then he does his whole sequence about the Scopes trial. But then after that, he does the bulk of the material on Leopold and Loeb and recounting what happened with that case. And actually, the friend I was with, I turned to him and I said, you know, that's odd because Leopold and Loeb actually happened right before the Scopes trial. And he said, really? I got the impression from this play that you would think it was the other way around. So I don't know. I guess that maybe the playwright did that because he felt Leopold and Loeb was more interesting. I don't know.
I guess he must have. And I guess it was a stronger thing to consider, at least, that Leopold and Loeb would seem to have no basis for any type of defense, while, right. of course, the Scopes trial, we're on the side of the defendant, while we're not in the scope in the Leopold and Loeb trials. So it would seem that would be a harder mountain for Darrow to climb, given that there would be no sympathy for the boys, while there would be sympathy for the teacher.
One thing very interesting to me, I know Inherit the Wind quite well because I was in a production in junior high school, and then I own the movie and I've watched it many times, that excellent movie. And then I've seen at least two television productions, not to mention the several that I've seen on stage. So I almost feel like I know it word for word. And I was surprised to hear several lines in Clarence Darrow that were either verbatim or almost verbatim from Inherit the Wind, which can only lead me to believe that those lines were taken by Lawrence and Lee from actual transcripts and writings of Clarence Darrow and put in to Inherit the Wind, which I hadn't necessarily quite realized that they had quoted him directly like that. Did you know that, Peter?
Well, what fascinated me then was, okay, given the fact that this seems to be actual testimony, then why indeed fictionalize the play? Because it was not Clarence Darrow that was mentioned in the play. It was Henry Drummond. And so it right. wasn't William Jennings Bryan. It was Matthew Harrison Brady. So hearing the actual lines did make me think, wow, I wonder why it was fictionalized, since they seem to be so true to life.
Me too.
All right. So that was a two-night-only thing. So if you have missed it, you have missed it. The both of you also got over to Central Park to see Julius Caesar in the public theater Shakespeare in the Park, which I guess we'll have to talk about in two sections here. First, let's do the review of the show first, and then we'll talk about the aftermath of Julius Caesar after the review. So, Peter, why don't you start us off?
Well, of course, seeing Julius Caesar under any circumstances is always a great deal of fun. And I always think it's a very good play to introduce people to Julius Caesar. So it's a good show for kids, even though it does have a brutal murder in it, because it's one of the easier ones to, if you pardon the expression, translate. I do hope that people do get over there and see Julius Caesar and bring their kids. Now, that said, I did wonder tremendously if indeed this assassination was going to be applauded and cheered. Okay, now we know that Delta Airlines and Bank of America didn't cheer, but what had happened was I had gone on the 9th, which was the news broke that during the Tonys that Delta had pulled out. So this was before that, and I was wondering if they were going to cheer because, of course, as probably everybody knows by now, there is a concerted effort to make Julius Caesar Donald Trump. You have the red tie. I also noticed, and you had to be sitting on the aisle, you had to be sitting near the VOM when people exited at the beginning. Some of them were wearing red baseball caps that said Rome wasn't built in a day, which I thought was terrific, as opposed to Make America Great Again. So anyway, so he's definitely Donald Trump, the semi-orange hair, you know, all that kind of business. He's got a wife who speaks in an accent. One time she pushes away her husband's hand. So, all right. And before the show, we were told that one line had been changed. And yes, that had to do with Fifth Avenue, which is where Trump lives when he's not in Mar-a-Lago, or to a lesser degree, the White House. So clearly it's Trump. So they laughed. We all laughed at everything that made Trump look bad or made him look foolish, including his being talked out of staying home when his wife wants him to stay home, that it takes him a second to, in no time flat, to say, yeah, I'm going, you know. So so that was kind of interesting. Now, what's really wonderful, and I mean that, is that when he was knifed, he was suddenly to everybody Julius Caesar, not Donald Trump. Nobody cheered, nobody applauded, and I was very proud of the audience because, after all, two wrongs don't make a right, you know. So I thought that was good. But, you know, for me, the whole analogy fails tremendously because I may be reading Julius Caesar wrong, but boy, I think Shakespeare's point was pretty much condensed in a line that one of the citizens says, which I did not hear. Now, it may be simply I did not hear it, but there is the line, "I fear there will a worse come in his place." And that's essentially what happens in Julius Caesar. At least that's my interpretation of it, that we're worse off for the assassination. Now, I do not want Donald Trump to be assassinated. I don't want him to become a martyr, all that kind of business. But I don't believe, and here we're getting terribly political, I don't believe that if he were to disappear, or let's say resign, if he resigned tomorrow, that, with the approval figure now being at 36%, I don't think most of the nation would feel bad if he resigned. So the whole analogy of this production fails terribly for me, given the... To me, they're saying, you know, we were lucky and we didn't know it. We had something good and we ruined it. So that's I thought was very strange. And Michael, you seem to agree.
Oh, I do agree. I'm looking at the note in the program that Oscar Eustace wrote, which says at one point, "The difficulty in determining the protagonist of Julius Caesar, there are at least four credible candidates, is not a formal weakness of the play, but rather essential to its structure." So then does that mean to imply that we cannot determine the protagonist in the actual Trump America situation? I guess we can. I mean, we individually can, but is that the point that this production is trying to make overall, that it's hard to tell whether or not Trump is a protagonist? Yeah. I mean, I hate to be simplistic or literal, but my first thought when I heard this play was going to be done as a Trump analogy or whatever, I said, why didn't they do Richard III instead? Now, of course, you know, any Shakespeare play you pick is not going to line up immediately and completely with the facts of Trump. And actually, that's my main thing, is that I put this production in kind of the same camp as what I thought was the ridiculous production of Othello at the New York Theater Workshop that Sam Gold directed, as lauded as that was. And even though you had to sell your firstborn if you wanted to try to get a ticket, because as I said then, every other line in the play makes absolutely no sense in a modern context. And even the formality of the language in this case. Does anyone feel that Donald Trump speaks informal language?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So,
yeah,
you know, yeah. So it completely destroys any illusion they're trying to make by the way the wig he's wearing and the way he's dressed and the fact that his wife looks like Melania. You know, I just don't get it. Then another similar thing with Othello is, you know, people are plotting murder and they're talking about daggers, and they have daggers in their suits, and they pull out the daggers and they show them, and then they use the daggers. And then at one point later on, there was a riot scene where with police in riot gear, but the mob was fighting the police with their fists. And then, of course, at some point, suddenly guns start being used when before that, all we've seen is daggers and fists. I just don't understand what that's supposed to mean. I also do not understand if you're going to make Mark Anthony, if you're going to have her played by a woman, what exact point are you trying to make? And is that point muddied by keeping the character name Mark Anthony, but changing the pronouns from him, his, and he to her, hers, and she? What exactly are they saying about Mark Anthony? Is she supposed to be a woman or not? Is it not supposed to matter? And if so, why change the pronouns but not the name? I get it. And so lots of things like that happen all through the night. One specific thing is that that incredibly effective scene of the murder of Cinna the poet. Cinna the poet, played by the amazing Yusuf Bulos, whom I have seen on stage for about 40 years or more now. He gets murdered because he mistaken identity. They mistake him for someone who is not in support of the.
Cinna was a conspirator,
right?
But not Cinna the poet, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. And so, but I actually did not actually read it, but I'm almost 100% sure that in the original, Cinna is murdered by the mob.
That's right.
It's a crazed mob, you know,
that's
with
right.
bloodlust. Here, he's murdered by the police, which, you know, is effective in its own way, but it is really quite different from what Shakespeare wrote. So I think there was a lot of messed up stuff here, although, of course, I would defend, you know, to the death, the right for them to do it. But the other thing is, you know, and we can't really get into this, but I guess an argument can be made that to depict the murder or the assassination of a president on stage, of a sitting president on stage, is just so dicey that some people would argue, and I can't really disagree, that perhaps it should not be done at all. And we only have to look at what the example that was given of us to us, that this was done not that long ago in 2012 at the Guthrie, when Julius Caesar apparently was produced with a Obama-like figure as Julius Caesar. I for one, do not think that I would like to see an Obama figure murdered on stage while he was president, even if we all understand the point, which apparently a lot of people don't, that the play is trying to make, that this is not the way to deal with that kind of situation. It's the worst way possible to deal with it.
All right. So there is Julius Caesar, and I think that it closes this weekend, or is it next weekend? It's the public runs these things for a very long time before their official opening dates, and then they have 1 or 2 weeks before they close it right after that and move on to their next production. So next thing up, we're going to talk about the cost of living. Michael and Peter both got a chance to see that. Michael, why don't you start us off with that?
Yes, I just wanted to mention it briefly because I think this is a very, very talented playwright who I hope I will say her name right, Martina Majok. And I have seen her previous work, and I think that she really is one of our best younger playwrights. I assume she's younger. and this play is a really intriguing one in several ways, but largely for the fact that it has not one but two disabled actors in it, if that's the correct term to use. One of them is Greg Mozgalla playing John, and the other one is Katie Sullivan playing Ani. And basically the play is about how these two disabled people end up in the care of two other characters, Eddie played by Victor Williams, who is who aligns with and hooks up with and winds up caring for Ani, and Jess played by Jolly Abraham, who is a caretaker for John. And it's about their interaction and how much of an issue the disabled factor is. But I think that it was very, very well done, in a way that was not manipulative or cloying to any extent, which I think it can be very difficult to write about a subject like that. Directed by Joe Bonney, very, very well, I might say. And there was one moment in it in particular that I really loved, where one of the characters, Jess, feels that she thinks she is actually being approached romantically by John, and you can tell it's something like that would never have occurred to her before, and that maybe she's hesitating a little bit because he is disabled. But then she really gets into it, and she dresses up for their date. But then it turns out that it was a terrible misunderstanding, and he was talking about someone else who he's going out with. And you could see her disappointment, and it was so touching. And really very moving that you could see that she had really come to the point where she was really looking forward to having a date with this fellow, and that she was completely able to see beyond his disability. So I think that this is a really wonderful play that you will, I hope, see in many productions in the future.
All right, Peter, what'd you think?
Well, I had a completely different reaction to that scene. It was one that made me really question what the playwright was doing. Yes, Michael described it very well. Indeed, he does lead her to believe that they're going to have not just an ordinary clean me up, do this, do that situation, but a genuine date. And she dresses for it. She brings out her best dress, we assume anyway. But I mean, she certainly doesn't look the way she looks when she shows up for work every day. And my problem here was that he didn't notice. Yes, he's physically disabled, but the way he treated the situation would lead us to believe he was mentally disabled, because he never catches on to her disappointment. He doesn't seem to notice that she's wearing a different dress. He should have picked up and say, what actually happens is he indicates that he actually says that he's interested in somebody else, and he should be able to pick up the clues, if not by the dress, but by her disappointment. I wanted him to say, Jess, I'm sorry. I apologize. Oh, I can see where you thought that. That's what I needed, and I didn't get that. Disabled, yes, he is physically disabled. He has a problem with his arms and his legs. But it's far more effective, of course, when Ani comes out, Katie Sullivan, because she's in a wheelchair, and we see that her legs have been amputated above the knee. And at first we have the inclination to say, gee, I wonder how they hid her lower legs, because at this point we don't know that she actually is an amputee, a double amputee. And it doesn't take us very long to say, wait a minute, that's the real thing up there. And so she's very brave, of course, to be able to do that. And she even has a scene in a bathtub where she's naked. And by the way, Greg Mozgalla playing John is naked at one point, too, much more demonstratively so. But I found her voice terribly strident. And if we were just judging on performance alone, and that's certainly something that we might do, I didn't like her very much as an actress. So, but I loved Victor Williams playing Eddie, a very sensitive performance about a man who was once in love with this woman before she had the accident. And then they got separated, legally so, and then she had the accident. And he's there for her. So that part of the play is quite beautiful. He never thinks about ever dumping her, even though they had been legally separated. They were on a trajectory not to see each other again. But the love came back when she was in trouble. And that's really terrific. Yeah. So that part of the play I like immeasurably. I would have liked this play aside from that one objection that I had. I wish he had caught on. So aside from that, I'm fine with it.
Well, just quickly, I could be wrong, but I thought I remembered him referring to the fact that she was so nicely dressed. And then she said something that that he misinterpreted. I seem to remember that, because if you're right and he didn't acknowledge it at all, then that would be a bit really big flaw.
the point is her disappointment is so palpable, and he keeps on talking about the fact that, you know, he's interested in this other woman and
this
would be great and all that kind of stuff. So I wish he had caught on. He should have. There were certainly enough clues, and her disappointment, she was so stunned. As well she should be.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, I mean, the playwright really sets us up wonderfully, wonderfully. I want to stress that, because we really do believe that she's really interested in him for his own sake, and to hell with the disability. And that's really a wonderful thing when people can do that. And then to pull the rug out from under us, fine, do that. But then let him acknowledge it and feel terrible, too. I think it would have had far more power if he really, really addressed the issue.
Yeah, that would have been really moving if he did realize it and he felt incredibly embarrassed and sorry.
Right. That's what I wanted. So anyway.
All right. So that's at City Center, Manhattan Theater Club, at City Center, Stage 1. And it is limited run, playing through July. So check that out if you'd like. And we'll have links to that in the show notes. Michael, I'm very jealous because you got over to the Barrow Street Theater to see the this new production of Sweeney Todd that's happening with Norm Lewis. So tell us about that.
This is one of the best shows I've ever seen in my life.
Oh,
you have got to see this. I never expected that I would love it this much. As you've all heard, it's done in a recreation of an actual pie shop, in which before it came here to the Barrow Street, this production was done in London at an actual pie shop. And I guess they couldn't find one here. We don't have pie shops like they do in England. So they took the Barrow Street Theater, which has been so wonderfully malleable for so many different shows, including David Cromer's Our Town and many others that I've seen recently. You never know what you're going to find when you walk in there as far as how it's configured and things of that sort. So I would have loved to see the original two British leads, but that's fine because I got Norm Lewis and Carol Lee Carmello as Sweeney and Mrs. Lovett, and they were both amazing. We have Matt Doyle as Anthony Hope, and we have Brad Oscar as Beetle Bamford. And then the other people, Tobias is John Michael Lyles. I think these other people I'm about to mention are all still the originals. Alex Fink as Joanna, who is built in the play, in the program, as Joanna Barker. Isn't that interesting? I don't think I've ever seen that before. Jamie Jackson as Judge Turpin, incredibly creepy. Stacey Bono as the beggar woman, Adolfo Pirelli. I think that was one of the two missteps of the entire production. To me, it doesn't make sense for Pirelli to be a woman, just because I miss that male-male dynamic between Sweeney and Pirelli. I just think that's really important. But other than that, I mean, there's a lot of doubling in this, because the entire cast is all of those people I just mentioned. So that's 1, 2, 3, 7. And the only other negative, let me get it right out of the way, was there were a couple of cuts that I missed, most specifically the letter that Sweeney writes to Judge Turpin when he's trying to convince the judge that he's trying to help him get Joanna back. That to me is one of the most beautiful parts of the score. And I guess they cut it because they didn't feel they had the voices to cover it. But I wish they had figured out a way to do that. Other than that, the score reduces incredibly well for three musicians. Music director, piano is Matt Aument, or Aument, violin Tomoko Akabashi, and clarinet Michael Bro. There is a paradox of great scores, great music, that on the one hand, they sound so beautiful when you have them played by a 30-piece orchestra, but also I think they lose less when they are played by smaller ensembles than a score that is not as good. I think that's a really interesting paradox, and I think that certainly applies to Stephen Sondheim's incredible, magnificent masterpiece score for Sweeney Todd, directed brilliantly by Bill Buckhurst. They had ingenious solutions to almost all of the problems created by this staging, including the fact that there is no barber chair by which to dispose the victims. I don't want to say too much more because you really I know I say this a lot. You really, really, really should try to get to this. I spoke with Carol Lee Carmelo afterwards a little bit, and she said, I said, is it open-ended now? And she said, well, they're selling tickets till Christmas. Oh, so. Nice. Yeah, so you have ample opportunity, even though the number of seats for each performance is very small. But still, it's open-ended now, and I don't think it's as impossible to get tickets as it was when the show opened. So please put it on your list.
Wow, that's and it's a small theater. Did you get a pie?
I didn't do the pie package.
The pie package. Not all seats can you get a pie. And it's a very small theater, and it's getting just similar to what Michael is saying. Everybody's raving about it. So if you can get to it, get to it. We'll have links to that in the show notes as well. And check it out if you get into town. So next up, Somebody's Daughter at Second Stage Uptown. Michael and Peter both got a chance to see that. So, Peter, why don't you start us off there?
Talk about starting off. I thought this play started off like a house of fire. I really enjoyed it immeasurably for the first few minutes because it does deal with a young Asian girl who's very, very shy, very introverted. We will soon learn why. But she goes to her guidance counselor about she's in high school and what college is she going to be going to because her marks are astonishing. She's a tremendous achiever, and all that's fine, but this girl looks pretty miserable indeed, and we'll soon find out why. Because one of the points of the play is that so many times we have parents who are just so intent on making his or her child succeed, that is the be-all and end-all. Whether or not the kid is happy is certainly in second place. So the kid's only 15, and they're already talking about college because she's such an achiever. Okay. Now, it gets complicated and melodramatic when the kid goes home because we meet the parents. And the mother is horrible.
Just beyond
horrible, and we often hear about Asian dragon ladies and how that stereotype shouldn't happen anymore. Well, it's happening right now in Chisa Hutchinson's play, because the kid comes home and says, "Hey, I'm a finalist for a prize," and the mother says, "Only a finalist?" the fact that the whole situation hasn't even been resolved yet, and yet the mother is not saying, honey, that's wonderful, but only a finalist. There's also an issue with the mother being pregnant. The mother has tried in the past to have a son. That's an important value, too, having a son. And when they found out not once, not twice, but three times that it was going to be a girl, she had an abortion. All right. So she's no kid now. She's an older woman, and now she's pregnant, and hallelujah, it's going to be a boy. It seems terrible to reveal the fact that that she loses the child, and she loses the child while she's having an argument with her daughter. And so she's certainly going to use this opportunity to claim the daughter caused her to have the abortion. And when the daughter rebuts and saying, no, the doctor said you're having three abortions, had a lot to do with it. The mother actually says, I wish it were four.
Mm.
So this is horrifying. And any reconciliation that allegedly happens at the end seems to be much too convenient. I mean, I certainly know a lot of people who are angry with their parents for less than this and won't forgive them. So the father is nicer, and certainly the daughter is the apple of his eye, but even he could be a little stronger about it. And of course, there is a complication when she finally gets her first boyfriend, very nicely played by Colin Kelly Sordelet. I don't have any issue with the acting in the play or the direction. The play is what it is, but wow, what started off so promisingly with the nice relationship between the girl and her guidance counselor, wonderfully played by Gina Yee, who has problems of her own, believe me. Yeah, no problem with them, just the play itself and the cliche of the Dragon Lady.
The other term for that is Tiger Mom, I believe. And this one is like that to the 10,000 millionth degree. Yeah. Yeah. And Peter didn't even mention the physical abuse. There's one horrible scene of physical abuse that the mother visits on the daughter. Yeah. I mean, I think that the point about this mother has been made by the playwright with a sledgehammer and to a very counterproductive degree. I just can't imagine what she was thinking in making her so incredibly horrible. And then trying to justify or explain or her behavior in a monologue at the end. Another review of this play that I read actually felt that that monologue worked to explain and justify and have us sympathize with the mother, and I could not disagree more severely. I just think it was one of the most horrible characters I've ever seen on stage, and I'm going to have to disagree about the direction. I think that it also yes, absolutely, all of this is in the play, in the text itself, all the exaggeration and all these melodrama and all the stereotypes, but I think it was heightened by, I believe it's pronounced May Adrales, M-A-Y Adrales. So who knows? I mean, I wasn't in the rehearsal room. This brought to mind to me that the famous story that Stephen Sondheim tells about how when he was very young, he was living next to Oscar Hammerstein, and he showed Hammerstein a musical he had written, and he said, oh no, I want you to be absolutely 100% honest, you know, in what you think. And so Hammerstein read the musical, and then, you know, they met a few days later or whatever, and Hammerstein said, you really want to know what I really think? And Sondheim said, oh yes, and he said, this is absolutely terrible. And Sondheim like got tears in his eyes because he was what, 16 or something like that?
15 in fact.
And then Hammerstein said, I said it was terrible. I didn't say that there's no talent here. And then he went through the entire musical and explained to him everything that was wrong with it and how it could be fixed. So I would kind of adapt that and say that this play is terrible, although it still shows some talent on the part of Chisa Hutchinson. Although the main difference there is that, as Peter just mentioned, Sondheim was 15 when he wrote that apparently awful musical. I don't think Chissa Hutchinson is 15. And according to her bio, she's a current recipient of the 2016 Toe Foundation grant for the creation, development, and production of this new play through Second Stage. It gives a list of her other plays and where they have been produced. And it also mentions she's won a GLAAD Award, the John Golden Award for Excellence in Playwriting, a Lilly Award, a New York Innovative Theater Award, the Paul Green Award, a Helen Merrill Award, the Lanford Wilson Award, and has also been a finalist for the highly coveted Pony Fellowship. So I, you know, maybe her other works are better than this one, because I certainly don't think that this, the level of writing that's seen here is worthy of that kind of acknowledgement and encouragement. I hope she keeps writing, but I hope she addresses the major, major issues in this play.
All right. So last review of the morning, we're going to talk about Michael got up to Lyrics and Lyricists over at 92nd Street Y, where he saw From Camelot to California, the Worlds of Lerner and Lowe. So, Michael, tell us about this.
Wonderful evening featuring Chuck Cooper, Lily Cooper, Bryce Pinkham, Ryan Silverman, and Lauren Worsham. Rob Berman, artistic director, writer, and host. Chase Brock, stage director. So many wonderful moments from the Lerner and Lowe canon. I wanted to single out, and this is the kind of thing you'll find at places like, you know, Lyrics and Lyricists that you're not going to find anywhere else. They did a whole section where there's a famous story of how initially the song On the Street Where You Live was bombing when it was in My Fair Lady. And it took the creators quite a while to figure out what the problem was. Everyone thought the song itself was wonderful, but for some reason the audience was not reacting. And then someone realized, I think Lerner himself, that the audience did not seem to realize or remember or recognize Freddie Eynsford Hill from the Ascot scene. They thought he was, you know, this, because he was in a different costume and, you know, whatever. They just didn't make the connection. So to them, it was this kind of random person coming on and singing this love song to Eliza. So what he did was he replaced the original introduction sort of verse to the song with another one that completely spells out that this was in fact the same person from Ascot, including some references to what happened at Ascot, including Eliza's exclamation, "Come on, Dover, move your bloomin' ass." And then not only that, but they added a line where Mrs. Pierce comes to the door and Freddie asks to see Eliza, and Mrs. Pierce says, "You can't see her right now. They're having dinner." And Freddie says, "Well, if she doesn't remember me, tell her I'm the one who was sniggering at her," which is what had happened at Ascot. So they really made sure that they clarified it. And as soon as that happened, the song worked like gangbusters. But this, I had heard this story several times before and read it, but this was the first occasion on which I got to hear the original verse and the original longer bridge of the song performed very beautifully by Bryce Pinkham. So I am very thankful that I had that opportunity, and Lyrics and Lyricists is an invaluable series of that sort. We have just read that Deborah Grace Winer, who was the overall artistic director of the series, is leaving. She was a guest on our podcast a couple of months ago. We really wish her the best in all her future projects, because she really has the taste and the intelligence for this kind of thing, and we hope to see and hear more of that from her in the future.
All right, so that's the Lyrics and Lyricists series at 92nd Street Y. Always something very interesting to check out. And we have two other quick things to talk about here this morning. We also got the news that A.R. Gurney had passed away. So, Peter, what's been your experience with the Gurney shows?
Well, I remember seeing in 1974 at Boston University his first effort, Scenes from American Life. And while not every scene from American Life was terrific, most of them were. So, and of course, we naturally assume when we see a writer produced for the first time that he must be young. And it wasn't the case at all. He was already in his 40s. So proving it's not where you start, it's where you finish. My favorite memory of Pete Gurney occurs when I went to his apartment and I was thrilled to meet the original Sylvia Lucy.
That's right.
But what was really impressive to me, now he was having a play done at the George Street Playhouse in New Brunswick, New Jersey. So I was there to talk about the play. And I said, so tell me about the play. He said, well, you know, the artistic director, David Saint, called me up and said, look, I want to do something by you. Do you have anything new? And I said to him, well, David, yeah, I just had a reading of a new play, but I got to tell you, it's really laid an egg. And I thought, this is so amazing that here he is admitting that a play that he had written was not good. And this was a play that was about to be produced. And he wasn't the least bit worried about what I would think about the play based on the fact, well, if he doesn't like it, why should I like it? I mean, he was just being honest and forthright. And that was his reputation all along Broadway and off Broadway, even though he didn't come to Broadway very often, needless to say. He really was wonderfully beloved for his unassuming nature. And so he will be missed both as a playwright and as a man.
All right. Michael, anything to say there?
Well, I wanted to mention, first of all, that I just last year I saw a play that he wrote called Squash at the Flea. And it was notable for several reasons, including the fact that, as the press agent pointed out, at that age, he was dealing with an explicitly gay subject matter for the first time. And I think we were all very impressed by that. He was an extremely prolific gentleman, and I mean, extraordinarily so.
Yes,
and you know, and that in itself, is maybe not. If the stuff is no good, that wouldn't be an achievement. But I always found that whatever flaws I may have found in his writing, it was always very intriguing and well worth seeing. So he really is a loss. I noticed something odd that in the obituaries I read that none of them mentioned a play he wrote that was on Broadway called Sweet Sue. Mm. And I thought that might have been mentioned because even though it did not run long, it starred Mary Tyler Moore and Lynn Redgrave. Mm. Gurney, for all his prolificity, is that the word? did not have that many Broadway productions. So I'm surprised that didn't get mentioned. But whatever. He was generally given his due, I would say, in the obits, and everyone recognized his contributions. And I think there was also acknowledgement that he was generally considered one of the nicest people in show business. So I'm glad that was mentioned also.
All right. And finally, this morning, we have word from Mr. Riedel that Bruce Springsteen is coming to Broadway.
Oh, yeah.
not quite going to go into Waitress, but he is going to be doing a pared-down version of his concert, so says Mr. Riedel, for 8 weeks on Broadway, and coming up in the fall. So what do you guys think about
the Walter Kerr, is that correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what do you think about this?
Well, ticket demand is going to be bigger than it is for Hamilton, I would think, in this very small theater. Probably Hamilton and Dolly combined, because Lord knows the boss has his fans, and cramming them all into the Walter Kerr is not going to be an easy thing.
No, but you know what? I don't know a whole lot about him. My sister is one of his biggest fans in the world, but I have been reading a little bit, and I've learned some stuff over the years. Two things: he apparently is very, very much against high ticket prices, and he has always played throughout his career in small places, continued to play in very small places in addition to arenas. So I think that he's going to make a lot of people very happy. with that ticket price thing. And more, and you know, more power to him. I think it's absolutely wonderful. And I personally have no problem with Broadway theaters being used for things like this in, you know, for interim engagements. Another non, you know, non-actual theater thing that's going to be coming up is Michael Moore's show.
Oh, yeah.
So we have a lot of interesting stuff happening in the summer that's not actual theater, but is certainly going to be very, very theatrical in its own way.
So interesting what you're saying about the ticket prices. I hadn't thought about that. And surely, you know, Bruce Springsteen has been known to play very small rooms unannounced through all over the world and keeping the ticket prices low. I wonder if they're going to do something to try to negate the ticket resellers, the scalpers, from getting their hands on these tickets in some way. A lot of large popular groups, you know, like U2 or various other things, will sell tickets to their fans through their website in a pre-sale before it goes on sale to the general public. And usually there's very little, if any, tickets left. For like U2, I don't think there were any tickets left after they sold them to their fans through their website. And they have very strict restrictions on buying tickets. You can only buy 4 tickets or something like that. And they have to be in your name, and they check ID when you go to the place and things like that. So I wonder if they're going to be able to work something out like that, or if they'll just let it be a free-for-all. But I think a free-for-all in a 975-seat theater for 8 weeks or so is going to be very difficult. And I'm a very big Bruce Springsteen fan, and I've been to many, many concerts of Bruce's. And my fear is for the wear and tear of the theater.
Yeah, I thought of that too. Yeah,
I think there should be a $5 restoration fee added to each ticket, or some sort of "Hey, Bruce, we're glad to have you here. Why don't you put down a 200% deposit on this theater? You know, and we'll give it back to you after we get all the repairs done." So, and you know, I lump myself in with the Bruce Springsteen fans, so I'm not saying that the Bruce Springsteen fans are bad people. I'm just saying that I've been to a bunch of concerts where
they've been lively and carefree. Yes.
Yeah, where, you know, you kind of it's easy to hose down a stadium. It's hard to hose down a Broadway theater. So
Howard Rogan worked so hard to make that place a show place, and doing down to every detail that was there when the theater first opened.
Yeah.
So it'd be a shame to see that happen. Yeah. But, you know, people sometimes rise to the occasion, and that's what I'm going to predict.
And Bruce Springsteen fans have never seen ushers like Broadway ushers.
Yeah.
All right. So before we get on to trivia, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com, and there's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone or your BlackBerry Android device, or you can listen to us through iHeartRadio, through TuneIn, through Google Play, and the Apple Podcast Store. Wherever you get your finer podcast, you can find us. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, and for me, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today, can be found at BroadwayRadio.com. So, Peter, can you give us the answer to last week's trivia?
Well, it was actually Jack Leshner's question when he said, what musical from this decade actually contains the name of a musical from last decade? And the answer is Paramore from this decade and Amour from last decade. Mm. Elena Efremova was the first to get it, followed by Joss Israel and Donald Tessioni. Okay, next one. A movie was once made of a Broadway musical. It starred 3 performers. The first build would later do the lead in a film version of a play written by a man who's had a theater named after him. The second would later direct a film version of a smash Broadway musical, and the third would much later become the subject of a musical. What's the film and who are the three people who starred in it?
Wow, that is a great question.
Yeah.
Wow.
All right, so if you have an idea of the answer to that trivia question, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com. We will let you know if you're on the right track. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Knowing I'm on the street where you live, are there lilac trees in the heart of town? Can you hear a lark in any other part of town? Does enchantment pour out of every door? No, it's just on the street where you live. And oh, the towering feeling, just somehow you are near. The overpowering feeling that any second you may suddenly appear. People stop and stare, they don't bother me, for there's nowhere else on earth that I would rather be. Let the time go by, can be here on the street where you're